Professor Lipstein, you've been associated with the Faculty of Law and the Squire Library in various ways for the past 71 years. You've kindly agreed to share with me some of your recollections over this period, and I wonder if we could start in 1934, when you first arrived in Cambridge, and then we could cover the period leading up to the Second World War.
Well, clearly my work was concentrated on the Squire Law Library, because I was preparing a doctoral dissertation. The Squire Law Library was at that time housed in a building in Downing Street. And you can still see that it was, because there's a stone inscription which says that this was a building which was put up at the expense of Rebecca Squire and her husband and her brother. The library was on the first floor and was just one big room. That contained all the books that there existed. And then there was a little staircase which led up to the roof rooms. And there were the additional books which nobody wanted to look at. They were the ones on comparative law. They were the beginning of the library on comparative law, and that is where the professor sat, Professor Guttridge. Down below were only two people. There was the librarian, Mr. Staines, who didn't know anything about law, but he was simply there to catalogue the books and to stack them away when it was necessary. And he was helped by Mr. Hill. Mr. Hill did all the labour which was required. This he did during daytime. When that was finished, he served as a servant at dinner at Caius College. And then, when that was finished, he patrolled the streets with the proctor as a so-called bulldog with a nice black coat and a top hat.
So those were the librarians?
That was the librarian. Two men and one big room. The library itself was housed together with the law school, which was downstairs. And that is where I began. I didn't go to many lectures. I went to the ones on Roman law by Professor Buckland, which were indeed very good. And I do not believe that I went to it, as I was far too busy preparing my dissertation. But of course there were other people whom I met there. There was another PhD student. There were very few PhD students at the time. It was not done to do this. The degree had only been introduced after the war, and I think we were about the first, practically the first people to apply for it.
Very
and this meant with me was the Frenchman who later on became the famous Professor René David of France.
And were all the materials you needed available in the small library?
No, we used what we could use, and what we hadn't.
So how did this library compare with the library you were used to in Germany?
Well, so far as it was English law was concerned, it was, of course, a very comprehensive library. There wasn't that much yet at that time. There weren't that many periodicals or anything.
Right.
And textbooks were also not that frequent. So one could deal with that in one very big room.
Yes.
The foreign law library, of course, was just being built up, because Guttridge had only come to Cambridge in 1930 or 1931, and I came in 1934. So there wasn't very much yet. As I said, it was enough for two rooms in the roof.
Was he responsible for comparative law?
He was, yes. He had to lecture on conflict of law and was known as the reader in comparative law.
So he was eager to develop this.
He was the only one who bought it. Nobody else knew anything about it.
And prior to...
Nobody. He was. He did everything.
Right.
He did everything. Before him, there can't have been anything.
I see.
But he came in 1930, I came 4 years later. By that time, there was something.
Right. And between the two of you, you built it up over
and
the years.
And then, well, he was very much the man in charge till the World War.
Yes.
I was only a young foreign student.
What sort of a man was he, Professor?
He was, which, to describe him in English terms, a Yorkshireman. That is to say, he was thick-set, loved good food, loved good life, and what was extraordinary with him, he had grown up in part in Italy, because his father had been had some illness, and the doctors had advised him to retire to a country with a good climate. And so he retired to Naples. And if you go to Naples even now, you will find in the main square a men's outfitter shop called Guttridge. That was Papa, how he occupied his time. And Guttridge himself grew up there. He spoke fluent Italian, although he spoke it with a strong local accent, which the professors who visited him later on found very funny indeed.
When you say local accent, you mean a Yorkshire accent?
No, Italian accent.
Italian, understand. So he was fully conversant with Italian law.
He also had, by that time, had a lot of international contacts. He was one of the members of a United Nations committee which supervised the work of a committee in Rome on the unification of the law of arbitration, which in due course consisted of three people: René David from France, a German called Ficker, and an Englishman, Wortley. And that is how René David came to us, because in supervising this committee, Guttridge found out that David had another few years before he had to take up his job in France. So he said, come to England and join Trinity Hall, take a PhD. This is what David did, that's how I got to know him.
And what sort of a person was he, Professor, as you recall?
He was a man with much wit. The first year he joined the student body of Trinity Hall and Rhodes. This was the year when French governments fell every month one. He rowed, and one day he came and said, sorry chaps, can't row. What's the matter? I've become Minister of the Marine. Ooh! And he rowed off. 10 minutes he came back. It's all right, but chaps, I can now row. What's the matter? Minister has resigned. That was René David, who had, of course, a long career, which was a very famous one, both in France and in the... especially he made the code for Ethiopia later on. But the most famous thing is probably when he was made prisoner in 1944, and he was in charge of a unit and somebody still continued shooting. So they lined him up, lined the officers up and said, war crimes and you're going to be shot. But René David, when he had been himself a member of that committee in Rome, had told the Englishmen and the Germans always talk their own language with him. So he was absolutely fluent in German. So they replied in fluent German, you're committing a great mistake. I'm an intimate friend of General Goering. That, of course, stopped everything, and he was not shot, nobody was shot, and everything was survived.
You mentioned the other PhD students who you were with Daub. Was he somebody whom you had quite a bit to do with? Did you get to know him quite well?
We knew each other, but we came back from the same background and were both fighting our own way, and so I didn't see him an awful lot. I mean, we talked to each other, but he was clearly a very much better Roman lawyer than I did was. He had been assistant to a most famous German professor, had been recommended to Buckland in Cambridge, had been given a scholarship in Caius, and therefore he was quite clearly better than I, and so we didn't deal with our own subject matter because I knew that he was the one who was much better.
And you concentrated
much more on private international.
Yes.
I did Roman law, and I'd made a dissertation in Roman law, but I concentrated on private international law so that we didn't overlap.
Excellent. And then to that end you became Professor Guttridge's assistant.
He was very kind to me, because in 1936 I got my doctorate and I was invited to become a research fellow in Trinity, but I didn't get the research fellowship and so I had nothing. And although my British family was going to pay for me, it was really a rather awkward situation, especially since my British uncle didn't like people who had no firm occupation. And so Guttridge made me formally his assistant and paid me something.
And there were other lawyers at the time who were very famous, such as the Yule professor, Professor McNair.
McNair was an extremely kind man to me. I had an introduction to him from some other friends of mine. He was a man of few words, but very clear, very straightforward, and he had a seminar where we all met during term time to discuss topics, and he asked me to give a paper, and this was my first introduction to a paper in English, which was later on the basis of my article on international law and in public, private, national, international tribunals. This was open to all the teachers in public international law, the supervisors in public international law, and any students who were interested in it. It was a very nice meeting, which I remember with pleasure.
Which was attended by many famous people.
There were a number of them. There was Mervyn Jones, who later on wrote a very good book on public international treaties, and unfortunately died young. And there must have been quite a number of others whom I now can't remember. There always were a lot of people from abroad.
Do you have recollections of Professor Buckland, who was on the Library Committee between 1926 and 1934?
I certainly remember Buckland, because he was one of my first ports of call when I investigated coming to Cambridge. I was taken to him by a law fellow of Trinity to meet him at number 7 Grange Road, where he lived. His house is now nearly back to back with mine. There was the elderly gentleman, benevolent, very learned, and very much a civil lawyer. In fact, he was strictly limited to civil law. He did not know very much other legal systems. But within this, he was a great expert and a very kind old man. He was by that time nearly 70. We had a discussion in his library, and we agreed I should come and join the faculty. After that, I mainly went to his lectures, which were extremely good, very well prepared, but probably too difficult for youngsters.
So did he supervise your PhD?
No professor could supervise a PhD at that time. That is probably wrong. Dauber was probably looked after by Buckland. I wasn't. So I was looked after by Patrick Duff.
Do you have recollections of Professor Duff?
He was a classical scholar, but otherwise he did not excel. He did not produce any further work after he published a book and an article.
So, Professor, what do you remember of Mr. Harry Holland, who joined the Library Committee in 1930?
That is, of course, a very different matter. Harry Holland was a member of the Suffolk gentry,
where his family had a big estate, where his mother, he used to say, "My mother is a whore." That did not mean what you might think. The whore was spelled H-O-A-R-E. She was a member of a famous banking family. He'd been a pupil of Maitland and prided himself that he was interested in history, English law. Had been a fellow of Trinity, and before the First World War, since before the First World War, had been a major in the war, came back, and been a very dominant person. He acquired a predominant influence in Trinity College, where he became vice master. In my day, he was the vice master, and he really set the tone. He was very kind to me. The first days, of course, I was a complete outsider. But in the days afterwards, when I had become a supervisor, he used to see me quite a lot, because in 1944, I had become the secretary of faculty, and Harry Holland had been the chairman of the faculty for at least 10 years. So we met on Tuesday once a week to deal with the faculty affairs in his rooms in Trinity for lunch in order to settle all outstanding matters. A good administrator, a man of good common sense, probably not an outstanding lawyer, he did not produce any notable written work, but he always said that he might have produced the textbook on the new property law had Cheshire not done so. But he was certainly an outstanding personality who set his tone to the faculty very strongly, because he was very strongly influential in who was appointed, and the appointments were mostly due to him, including my own. A personal reference to him is to be found in Snow's book called The Master.
Professor, any recollections of Mr. Wade?
Emlyn Wade, not to be confused with Bill Wade, was a fellow of Keyes, a good constitutional lawyer, but a somewhat stiff former man whose imagination was probably not enormous, but whose knowledge was very good indeed, and whose good common sense emerged from the following, that when it looked in 1938 that there might be a war with Germany in this country, he asked, "But are you going to be under the prerogative?" Which for a constitutional lawyer meant, "Can you be interned without trial?" To which my answer was yes. He was that kind of straightforward man who could have a straightforward question or a straightforward answer.
Thank you, Professor. So, the Hirschlautkat, who is on the Library Committee from 1938 to 1954, helped to develop the international law collections, and perhaps you have some memories of him?
He came after a distinguished tenure in London. There may have been some doubts as to whether to appoint him or not to the famous chair, but finally he was, and he tackled his new task with energy. So shortly afterwards, the international law activities in Cambridge were certainly considerable. He was an editor of Oppenheim, he did all the lecturing. At the same time, he had to accommodate himself to the new surroundings in which he lived, which was now college life, which he hadn't done before. Fellowship was something new to him, but he established himself well, and of course, during the war, was constantly used by the government in England. He had to go quite frequently to the United States.
Other famous names which you encountered during this period include the name of Professor Winfield.
Winfield was a fellow of St. John's and had at that time reached really the top of his career. He had written already a number of other things and then just written his famous textbooks on the law of tort. He was a man who was not very loquacious. He was very precise and very helpful. as I in turn, I think, was helpful to him, because in his book there appear all sorts of references to me when I was only a little research student. So we must have had some conversations and things together. He was a good lecturer, but altogether a man whom one trusted the moment one saw him, absolutely straightforward. So was McNair. So was McNair.
Another name which springs to mind is that of Professor Hazeltine.
Hazeltine was an American, and he had had an interesting career because he had studied legal history in Germany with some of the most famous German people, and then come to England and had a Downing professorship, which at that time meant that he had a house in Downing College. But since he was divorced, I think, or his wife may have died, was alone, served by a butler. And I used to go there quite a bit because I discussed certain problems of legal history with him. He was a very forthcoming, a very friendly man who was well of considerable knowledge, though he had not much influence because he did legal history and was an American. And as soon as the war broke out, he was persuaded to go back to America, and so I never saw him after that again.
Very interesting. When you did your PhD, one of your supervisors was Professor Jolovitz, who at that stage was in London. Do you have any recollections of him?
He was only my examiner, and so I met him when I was examined for my PhD.
Yes.
So I can't really, this is the father of Tony,
yes.
I can't say much of that. I remember being once there for the oral examination. No, I can't.
Did you go down to London?
I had to go down to London in his house, and that was the examination.
And that was in
1936.
And then in 1937 you became Professor Guttridge's assistant. And
started supervision.
And research, an active program of research. And you were also given the job of the upkeep of the foreign law section of the library. That was one of your duties.
Well, that was one of my duties. I had to rearrange it. Professor Guttridge, of course, had always the last word. I was merely the help.
Did you select material?
I cannot remember. But we must have done so. But we didn't buy that much at that time. We kept it to the main textbooks and one or two periodicals and nothing more. The budget was obviously very much smaller.
So this takes us up to the May of 1940,
mm-hmm.
where we know that you had the unfortunate experience of being interned in Liverpool until September 1940. And once again, during that experience, you met some very wonderful, interesting people, including the grandson of the late German Kaiser.
Indeed, I did.
And do you have any recollection?
The only funny recollection I have was that we were given special writing paper which was so prepared that you couldn't send secret messages. It looked awful. And he was there and saying, "Very awkward, very awkward. My aunt has a birthday. I cannot send her this." That was Queen Mary.
That was odd. Oh, my goodness. And there were other very illustrious people in that gathering who, for example, Justice Kerr was one.
Oh, Lord Justice Kerr, of course, was a student at Clare College at that time. One didn't know that he was going to have a very good career. He was just a little law student.
Gosh,
No, of famous people, or also not yet famous. There was Perutz, who later on got a Nobel Prize for his structure of hemoglobin. There was the future Astronomer Royal for Scotland. There were one future professor of medicine and of biology in Cambridge. There were quite an interesting lot of people.
That must have uplifted you despite the seriousness of the circumstances.
One lived from day to day and didn't look around very much.
Yes.
It was, so how to survive?
Yes. So you were released in September and then you returned to Cambridge and you continued with your supervisions, and in 1944 you were married, and I've read in several works that this was a turning point. You look upon that as a very important milestone.
After all, it's one thing being an old bachelor and starting a married life. And of course I was very fortunate to marry a woman who was very much a personality in her own right. And I'm not going to give you the history of all she did, but I can tell you that she ended up as one of the backers of the New Liberal Democrats, as the city councillor, as a brown owl, as everything which had to be dealt with, she dealt with.
Very interesting. And then you, in that same year, were appointed as secretary of the Faculty of Law.
Yes, well, of course, in the First World War, the University of Cork closed down. They didn't do that in the Second World War. But, of course, there were very few people to study, only those who either were not called up because there were some defects, physical defects, or because they were waiting to be called up very young, or foreigners, mainly from the Commonwealth country.
So things continued.
But it obviously is all very much restrained,
yes,
until suddenly peace broke up.
Yes.
And then suddenly the faculty from 30 became one of several hundred students.
Oh.
And that meant a tremendous amount of work preparing everything for the return. I had to.
And you then in 1946 became a lecturer.
In 46 I became a lecturer, yes.
Yes. Well, that takes us up to the end of the period, which I hope we would discuss.
Good.
And the next time perhaps we can do the next chunk.
Well, think about that.
Yes.
That's much more difficult to say, because I lectured and administered. I can't tell you an awful lot about the library. I can tell you what we did when you moved it here.
Yes. Thank you, Professor.
Right, thank you.
Thank you.
Have we forgotten something?